Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. In comedy clubs nationwide tonight, there will be jokes about race relations. They do this, we do that, us and them. We'll see how the audience reacts when things get more complicated. What about you? What are you doing this weekend?
Well, I'm glad you asked because I forgot my husband is a musician and he has a concert. So it's my anniversary on Saturday, so it's a good thing I'm not forgetting all that.
This weekend, I plan on taking my grandchildren sledding.
I am going to go listen to the Ambassadors of Harmony Barbershop Chorus. I do have a little bit of a bias. My husband sings with them.
This weekend, I will be studying for finals for the very last time because I'm graduating from college.
I am singing at the Bistro, Jazz at the Bistro. So if you're not doing anything, you're in St. Louis, drop by.
You heard him, the Bistro, St. Louis.
Ah, that must be soul jazz vocalist Brian Owens at the Bistro on Olive Street. I hope we just sold out his show. Those voices came from St. Louis, Chicago, and St. Paul, Minnesota.
Religious conservatives in Ohio are credited with helping President George W. Bush win that state and thus the election in 2004. And that year, too, more than 60% of Ohio voters approved a constitutional ban on gay marriage. Well, since then, the political landscape has changed. So-called values voters are now trying to do some political math. They're weighing the candidates that reflect their values versus the ones they think can actually win. From WCPN in Cleveland, Mari Saito reports.
In the afterglow of the 2004 election, Ohio's evangelical movement was re-energized. It finally seemed like the country's leaders were paying attention to socially conservative values, a pro-life, small government, and anti-gay marriage worldview. In the spring of 2005, over 1,000 pastors filled the pews of the World Harvest Church, a megachurch surrounded by cornfields in central Ohio.
For too long, the values that we have held dear have been trampled underfoot. While we are the largest special interest group in Ohio and in America today, and I, for one, say enough is enough.
Pastor Rod Parsley was talking to religious leaders about what role they could play in hardball politics. Their eyes were set on the 2006 governor's race. And even though conservative ministers like Parsley carefully avoided official endorsements, it was clear their guy was Ken Blackwell. He came to national prominence as Ohio's controversial chief elections official in 2004. He's known to carry a Bible to events. But Blackwell was looking to lead his state at the wrong time. Scandals among Republican leaders at the federal and state levels were starting to anger voters. A few days before the election, some Buckeye evangelicals like Reverend Richard Nathan broke ranks over the war in Iraq.
Many evangelicals are now saying, how did it come to be that we who claim to follow the Prince of Peace are the staunchest advocate of war of any demographic group in America? And, you know, even those of us who don't come from a pacifist tradition but come from a just war tradition have begun to say, how can some of our recent wars be considered just?
The Republican Blackwell lost, scoring only 39% of the vote. And Ohio's religious right found themselves under attack. Liberal ministers filed a complaint with the IRS, alleging that two Ohio pastors were using their churches for partisan politics. One of them was Pastor Russell Johnson. He won't talk about a possible IRS investigation, but he says conservative evangelicals are still a force to be reckoned with in Ohio.
We believe that we are citizen soldiers. We're here on the home front to get informed, get registered, get ready to vote.
The problem for values voters in 2008 is who to rally around. 50-year-old businesswoman Diane Stover spends most of her free time studying the presidential candidates. She shares what she learns with her email list of nearly 1,000 voters, people who say they're looking for candidates that share their moral beliefs and aren't necessarily Republicans.
The party has, in some respects, let us down on the values side, but we're holding out hope.
Stover works out of her suburban Cleveland home. On her fridge sits her favorite red coffee mug with the words Culture Warrior printed on the side. She got it from Fox News commentator Bill O'Reilly's website. She doesn't actually drink coffee out of it. She keeps it around as a reminder of what's important to her.
There's kind of this battle going on for our culture in America that it's a battle between the progressive way of thinking and the traditional way of thinking. And so I just got the mug and kind of what, you know, I thought was a good one for me.
Stover's been watching the political chess game on the right as evangelical leaders throw their support behind different candidates. And she's already thinking hard about her toughest scenario, having to choose between a Democrat like Hillary Clinton and a pro-choice Republican like Rudy Giuliani.
If he were the nominee, I wouldn't be all jumping up and down excited. He wouldn't be representing the values that I have necessarily, but I think he's got a lot of good things going on there. I would pull the lever or whatever, the punch card or whatever for him if it were him and Hillary Clinton.
Judging by the bumper sticker on Stover's car, she's most interested in former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee. The ordained Baptist minister is the dark horse, now moving ahead in the polls, thanks in part to support from values voters.
When he can get his message out there to people, that's what they want to hear. And look, he's surging. America's largest voting bloc does have a very influential opportunity to put people in office that are going to help us here.
At least, that's what values voters are hoping to show in 2008. The question for Stover is, can a conservative candidate like Huckabee survive the early primaries? Ohio's presidential primary isn't until March 4th. In Cleveland, I'm Mari Saito for Weekend America.
Religion and politics certainly in the news this week, with Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney delivering his much-anticipated speech addressing concerns about his Mormon faith. Here's Romney from the George Bush Presidential Library in College Station, Texas.
A person should not be elected because of his faith, nor should he be rejected because of his faith. Let me assure you that no authorities of my church, or of any other church for that matter, will ever exert influence on presidential decisions.
Reaction to the speech has been mixed. Was this Romney's JFK moment? Was it what he needs to get his campaign back on track, if it ever was off track?
Yeah, Bill, the news shows have made a lot of the connection, or even the disconnection, between Mitt Romney's Mormonism and the Republican Party's large block of evangelical conservative Christians. Mormons themselves are even mixed about Romney's candidacy and about the attention that his candidacy is bringing to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. You know, some of them are saying that that attention is just too sensational and it's demeaning of their beliefs. Well, Paul Larson is a Mormon. He lives in Layton, Utah.
What I think is missing in the media coverage is more of the similarities between the Mormon faith and the other religions. You know, the fact that we believe in God, that we believe that we have a higher purpose, and, you know, to improve ourselves and to help our neighbors.
Shelley Hunter from Danville, California, says the Church of Latter-day Saints is not a cult.
The Mormon Church has a strong moral foundation and things that are positive and good in this world, and the people who are part of it are choosing to make those principles also part of their life. They're people who have come to the same conclusion that I have, that the church is true and that their families are blessed for being part of it.
Is there common ground between Mormons and conservative evangelical Christians? Here's Bruce Westergren. He's a Mormon from Denver.
There are connections between us and some evangelical groups, but the super-duper conservative Mormons can be about as stubborn as a Southern Baptist, and they won't have anything to do with anybody else. And so on that end of the spectrum, there's no contact at all, because all they want to do is argue. They don't want to look for common ground.
We also called up Clydie Gold in Salt Lake City. She was raised Methodist but converted to Mormonism as a teenager, making her the only Mormon in a family of evangelical Christians. She says her conversion did not go over very well.
My parents were very upset. I am the youngest of five. I have two brothers and two sisters. Apparently, at one point, my brother, who was in law enforcement at the time, there was a discussion of him coming to rescue me from the cult or something. Mm. Right now, it's kind of like it's the elephant in the living room that we don't talk about.
Well, you were raised Methodist. You're the only convert in your family. What appealed to you so much that you converted?
It just felt right. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It felt more accessible, or deity felt more accessible. The LDS Church, you're just taught to address Heavenly Father as your Father. Just speak to Him. Just have a prayer. And also, I think the idea of everybody in the LDS Church basically has a job, has a calling, contributes, and that rotates. And I liked kind of the lay ministry, everybody serves idea.
So
How would you say Romney's candidacy has affected your relationships with your family?
They ask questions, that, and they ask a little bit about the church, and that was a direct result of Mitt Romney announcing.
What did they ask you?
What do you believe? What's different? And you're always ready for the question about, you know, do you really believe Joseph Smith saw an angel? Do you really believe that there were gold plates in the ground and they've translated the Book of Mormon from them? You know, I mean, and why did they allow polygamy? I can't answer why they allowed polygamy. There's just the hot button issues that you sort of don't want to deal with, but that's what people go after.
How does your Mormon faith affect your political views?
I really think we should be caring for the poor, and we should be watching out for others, and that everyone should have universal health care. And I think that's part of my religion.
So are you going to vote for Romney because he's Mormon?
No, I'm not going to vote for Romney because I feel like he's too close to Bush. And I'm dissatisfied right now with the administration. But how much is that is because I listen to a lot of NPR? I don't know.
Clydie, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Well, what's important to you as we head into this ramped up election season? What would you like to see us cover here on Weekend America? And how do you think we're doing so far? Send us your feedback, questions, any concerns. Write to us at letters@weekendamerica.org. Or you can call and leave us a message. Get a pencil. 888-728-8728. Again, that's letters@weekendamerica.org or 888-728-8728.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
For a family of Afghan refugees, a photo holds the hope for the future. Coming up on Weekend America.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And in St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Desiree Cooper. Last year, 41,000 refugees were admitted into the United States. And this fall, we've been spending weekends in the towns and cities where the refugees resettled. We've been asking them, what's the one thing you brought with you to remind you of home?
I'm from Burma.
I came from Iraq.
I'm from Somalia.
I'm from Somalia, too.
I go to America.
We have carried with us
videotapes,
my dad's picture,
some very old Sunday school books.
Without your past, you're nothing.
This weekend, we meet the Sher Ali family in Amarillo, Texas. Ahmed Ali, the family patriarch, had been a military doctor in Afghanistan, but when the Taliban took over Kabul, he feared for his family. He hid in the mountains while his wife and 9 children walked to Pakistan, and there they applied for visas to the United States. What's the one thing they carried with them? A picture of their father and the hope that he could someday join them.
Hi, my name is Lena. I'm from Afghanistan.
And I came with my family, like my mom.
I'm Shafiqa Shirali. I have 9 children.
And my sisters and my brother.
Hi, my name is Maria Shirali. I'm the oldest of my family, sister and brothers.
We all come together as a refugee.
We're not worried about money in Afghanistan. Because in Afghanistan, my dad was a doctor.
We have a very big house in Kabul.
I don't remember how many rooms on it.
The only reason that we are moved from our country because of the Taliban.
We are sitting outside and we heard those bombing and shooting stuff. My dad was like, just let's leave.
And we worried because my dad, he was a doctor for the military. We heard the Taliban's kill a lot of people who work with the government.
My husband say, keep your children, you go. Because I go with you. Taliban kill you and the children and me.
We live at the early morning, but we don't get anything with us. Only the dress that we wear.
We were on the mountains for 13 days.
13 days.
And 12 nights we were like traveling.
Sometimes coming walking, sometimes come with the truck.
20, 30 trucks follow each other. It's all full of children and women. They all take him to different place.
We are come to the Pakistan, my husband not with us.
I make a dress for people and we make a little money. We start the life from the zero. We begin again.
There was a picture of my dad in my brother's wallet.
It was a black and white picture when he was young. It makes me so sad and I start crying because I missed him a lot and I said, I wish he was with us.
Somebody told for my mom there is a embassy. If you go there, they're going to help us with the food or something. And they decide to, they send us to United States, like a refugee.
I can't believe you believe me. I just think like this, oh God, you help me. Because that's too hard to go to different country.
When my mom came and told us that we were going to America, we were not happy to come in here.
Some people told us that the man is hug you, kiss you, if you want, if you don't want it. We are really afraid of this stuff.
When we came in here,
the only things that were important for us are dad's picture.
We make those pictures bigger, so we still have it.
Assalamu alaikum. How are you doing?
When we came to the United States after the few months, they told us that we should work and support our families. And then I find a job for the restaurant, like a Waffle House. I was waitress there. I working hard, but the money is not enough for me. But I think why I shouldn't open a little store for myself. Because I know a lot of refugee people here. They all need the stuff that we use to our country, but we couldn't find.
This shelf for African food. This pot for Bosnian people. That one's for Iranian people, you see?
And after that, the Russian people come here, Croatian, and everybody come and ask about there is stuff.
We get a lot of refugee people here.
My relative back home, they ask me, is it hard to a woman run like a grocery food? I told them, no, not at all. I feel more like Americans when I do this business.
Morning, front desk.
Now in Amarillo, I'm working at the hotel. I'm the front desk manager in here.
Yes, sir. Can I help you?
The other day, I was checking somebody, and he was asking me where my accent from, and I said, I'm from Afghanistan. He goes, oh, you're not one of those Taliban, aren't you? And I go, whoa, thanks, sir, but that's really rude. Some people, they do say those stuff, but who cares? We wasn't sure if my dad was alive or not.
My little sister, she was so young when we brought her. The only way to remind her of my dad to show his picture. She knows him as a seeing his picture. We all sisters have one copy of that in our purse. And always when I look at that picture, it reminds me like he's looking at me.
One day, somebody called me and said, "Hello? Hello, how are you? Oh my gosh, are you alive?" I say, "Yes, I'm alive." "Are you alive?" I say, "Yes, I'm alive." We are together crying. We are talking to the telephone in 30 minutes. So after that one, we are applying for he's coming here.
When my dad came from Afghanistan,
we wait for him until he get out from the airplane.
And when he walked in, it would just scream and yell and cry and hug him.
Oh, I thought I'm dreaming. I touch him. I say, "I can't dream that, or it's for real, my dad is here."
You know, it's right. Your husband is with you.
Even though I have my dad with me, still I love this picture because it keeps me remind of him. It's always keeping me to remind of him. We're all happy to have him back. I keep taking pictures with him and I feel like we're a complete family now.
This weekend, the girl's father, Ahmed Ali, is safe and sound. He's helping out in the family store in Amarillo, Texas. The store is called Amarillo International Foods. And you can find pictures of the store and of the Sherilee family when you head over to our website. And when you get there, you can hear Lena playing a record of her favorite song about Afghanistan. It's all on our web. Just check it out at weekendamerica.org.
So far in our One Thing series, we've met Iraqis in Detroit, Somalis in Portland, Oregon, Burundians in Phoenix, and Burmese refugees now living in Indianapolis. You can hear the stories of the immigrants and find out the one thing each of them brought with them to the United States. It's all at our website, weekendamerica.org. The One Thing series is produced by Ann Hepperman and Kara Oler.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Executive MPA Program.
Was her father a killer? A daughter searches for the answer in a samurai sword. Coming up on Weekend America.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper, and we want to know what song propels your weekend, your weekend soundtrack, if you will. It's a good way to hear new music along with your stories. This week, let's meet Megan Chaney. She listens to us in Fullerton, California on KPCC, and her weekend soundtrack is 20-something by Jamie Cullum.
After years of expensive education, a car full of books and anticipation, I'm an expert on Shakespeare, and that's a hell of a lot. But the world don't need scholars as much as I thought.
Megan, are you a 20-something?
I am, in fact.
Tell us how this is the soundtrack to your weekend.
You know, as a 20-something, this song really speaks to me, especially at the beginning. I'm an English major at Cal State Fullerton, and I'm going to be graduating in May. But the problem is that I'm an English major. And the question I get asked most frequently is, what are you going to do with that?
Uh-huh.
I think a lot on the weekends about, where am I going to go with life? What am I going to do? Where can I go in general? And this song poses a lot of possibilities and doesn't really give any answers, which is something that I kind of feel the same way about.
You don't have the answers?
Not yet. Hopefully I'll find them by May.
Maybe I'll move back home and pay off my loans, working 9 to 5, answering phones. Don't make me live for my Friday nights, drinking 8 pints and getting in fights.
How do you listen to this song?
You can't help but tap your foot. But I'm also doing a lot of thinking about what I'm going to do. Maybe I'm looking on the internet, on Monster, for jobs with people with English degrees.
Uh-huh.
I can write well. I have good comprehension.
You know, it sounds to me like Jamie Cullum is poking fun at 20-somethings. I could work for the poor, though I'm hungry for fame. We all seem so different, but we're just the same. I don't want to get up, just let me lie in.
I don't want to get up, just let me lie in. Leave me alone, I'm a 20-something.
Are you gently mocking yourself?
I think maybe it's more making fun of people prodding us. There is so much that we can do, and just give me a minute and let me pick what I want to do. You know, I want to sleep in. Just let me do it, for crying out loud.
Do you feel like we're breathing down your neck a little, Megan?
A little bit.
Yeah? You know, when I was your age, Megan, I didn't have all these options. I had to take over my father's worm farm.
I'm so sorry.
And that's completely not true, but I just feel like, as your elder, that's what I have to say to you.
Love ain't the answer, nor is work. The truth eludes me, so much it hurts. But I'm still having fun, and I guess that's the key. I'm a 20-something, and I'll keep in me.
Why are you 20-somethings that way, Megan? Speak for your entire generation.
I think my parents did a great job raising me and telling me that I could be anything I want to do.
Wow.
And I don't think it was a disservice, because I think it's made me be creative and have a lot of fun. But I also think that it has left me in this quandary of, what can I do? Which is, because I can do anything, what will I do?
As a new parent, I'm writing this down, Megan.
I hope it will be helpful in the future.
Well, I do think you can be anything you want. Have a great weekend, Megan. Thanks for sharing your weekend soundtrack.
This is so much fun, Bill. Thank you.
So, in the soundtrack to your life, what plays when the weekend comes around? Maybe it's a song of recreation. Maybe it's the tune that was playing at a pivotal weekend moment in your life. We'd like to hear what that song is and maybe even play it for America. Get in touch with us at weekendamerica.org.
America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, this is the show about the spirit of the weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles.
And I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
66 years ago today, people around the nation, around the world, heard this on the radio.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Those words, of course, from President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It's how he began his speech to Congress, his declaration of war on Japan. And within days, we're at war with Germany and Italy as well. The attack on Pearl Harbor killed 2,403 people, and it drew the United States into a war that would change the fate of millions. Reporter Chrissy Clark will be thinking about one thing in particular this weekend, one of her dad's old war stories.
My dad was 52 when I was born, which meant his coming-of-age stories were different than my friends' dads. They didn't start with the Summer of Love or Vietnam. They started with Pearl Harbor. He was a senior in high school in San Francisco, and when he heard about the attack, he headed to the beach with thousands of his neighbors to stare in the direction of Hawaii and wonder if they were next. At least that's the story I heard. It's impossible now to confirm that story or any of his war stories because my dad died when I was 14. As a kid, I tried to listen to him when he talked about the war, but I didn't retain much. I remember the songs he taught me. I liked the dirty one about the sailor who knocked up the Cockney barmaid. But the stories he told me only come back in bits and pieces. He was an officer on a minesweeper in the Pacific. I remember something about a ship called the Minivet, something about a boat anchored near him that blew up, and an army jeep he tried to liberate to drive across China. And then there was the story about the samurai sword that hung above the fireplace when I was growing up.
I couldn't really relate to it hanging above the fireplace.
Here's my mom.
But I never, when we were married, I never suggested that he take it down. I mean, that was sacred to him.
As sacred as the sword was to my dad, no one in the family remembers the whole story about how he got it. This is what my mom and my oldest brother could piece together.
The story I heard, they were going up the Yangtze in China.
The Japanese had already surrendered, and yet a Japanese soldier
came screaming down at him with his sword raised.
It was probably about honor.
They turned the machine gun on him and
your dad killed him.
So I mean, obviously he was expecting to die when he came down the hill at it. It was not a stealth operation.
My dad was the highest ranking officer involved in the incident, and so he got to keep the soldier's sword and helmet as souvenirs.
Or at least that's what I think I remember.
That's what I think I remember too. Plus the fact that I was shocked when my dad told me he'd killed the person who owned the sword. He said, "That's war, Chrissy. It was either him or me." And even as a kid, I could tell the sword meant something to him. Now I wanted to see it again for myself.
I know I put it in a place where I didn't think my sons could get on it.
Since my dad died, my brother Paul had been storing the sword and the helmet under his house.
There it is.
There was a spider living inside the helmet, and the ray skin on the sword was crumbling, but the blade was keen. I brought it all home and hung the sword next to my bed.
I think the guy was a colonel.
How do you know that? Two of the hardest kinds of stories to verify are sea stories and war stories, and this one was both. I ordered my dad's naval records, no mention of the sword, but they did list the name of the boat he was on, the YMS 271, and the names of its commanding officers. The only one I could find was Ralph Patsfall in Cincinnati.
Hello?
Hello, is this Ralph?
Yep.
The minesweeper only had 32 sailors on board, so I thought the story of the sword must have traveled to Patsfall. I asked him if he remembered my dad.
Well, he was a navigator, tall, dark-haired. And
that's about all he could say. He did remember playing a lot of bridge. The crew hated eating lamb. And what about the attack by the Japanese soldier when the 271 was up the Yangtze River in China?
And the 271 was never in China.
I looked into it, and he was right. The 271 was in Japan and Saipan, but never in China. Either the combined memories of my mom, my brother, and me are wrong, or my dad was. I went to the National Archives in Maryland. The record said my dad was on temporary duty before he boarded the 271, maybe duty in China. I found other boats he might have been on, tracked down crew members. They were either dead or didn't recognize his name. I looked through ship deck logs, no mention of the sword in the months of daily entries. But one entry caught my eye. It read, "Flag placed at half-mast in mourning for the men who died while serving aboard the USS Minevet," the boat my dad had talked about. His signature followed each entry in the log. My dad used to take the sword down sometimes at family functions. He let my cousin use it to cut his wedding cake. But mostly it just hung there, above the fireplace. I would stare at it. Imagine my dad pulling it off the body of a dead man.
Richard, be careful.
Yeah, I've done that before.
Look the other way, dear.
Richard Saran is an expert in Japanese swords. His wife, Dory, looked on as he inspected my dad's sword from odd angles and then took out a giant rubber mallet. Most of the Japanese swords used during World War II were army-issued, mass-produced in the 30s and 40s. There was only a slim chance my dad's sword was an old, handmade one, but Saran thought it might be.
That particular temper line, the pattern there on the edge, and that was never done by anybody during the World War II days.
But in order to know the age of the sword for certain, Saran was looking for a sword maker's signature. That's why he was hammering, to dislodge the makugi, the wooden peg that holds the handle onto the hilt.
Hey, I think.
After 10 minutes, he finally broke the makugi apart and pried off the fixtures.
Yes, we do have a signature.
The name on there is Nagatsuna.
The sword was handmade. He consulted his books and estimated it was forged near Osaka in the 1660s, about 340 years old. He pointed to the engraved feathers on the handle, a family crest.
Common sense, common sense.
A family crest means a previous family owned it. Harunaka Hoshina runs a sword school in a tiny storefront in the foggiest part of San Francisco. He helps identify swords and reunites them with their previous owners in Japan. I showed him my sword, and he agreed on its age. Judging from the tassels, he thought the sword belonged to a field officer.
So probably that through the generation in his family owned it, you know, then took it to war, like for comfort. You know, this is not going to protect you, right? The guns and the rifle and the atomic bomb will protect you, you know, but... So this is a spiritual thing.
So could he help me find the previous owner's family?
Kind of hard to find. Probably the guy don't want anymore.
Why not?
This is a wartime and scary and. But this one is, you should fix it up and maybe it can become your family heirloom.
Hajime.
Hello.
Ted Everston is a retired policeman from Phoenix, and his dad also brought home a Japanese sword during World War II. A few years ago, Everston tracked down the family who'd owned it. There was a silk tag on the sword with the original owner's name on it. Takashi Uchimi is that man's son. He's 70 now. He'd barely known his father, who'd died of typhoid fever during the war when Uchimi was just a boy. Everston contacted Uchimi to tell him he wanted to return his father's sword, and he got this letter back.
It was addressed to me. Thank you for your letter. I am also very pleased to know that the sword was treated well somewhere in the world.
I got them on the phone together. Uchimi doesn't speak English, so a friend translated.
He doesn't have many memories about his father, so he feels like it's part of family comes back to the house, like... Sword is like a father, kind of. And so it would be nice to have to hold.
It would be nice to have to hold. I think I knew what Uchimi was talking about. It felt good to have my dad's samurai sword nearby. Even if I didn't know for certain how he'd gotten it or who it belonged to first. The annoying thing that happens when a person dies is that you can't have new conversations with him. Everything stops cold. Trying to learn more about this rusty sword had let me start a new conversation with my dad. I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
You can see photos of the sword and a video of students practicing kenjutsu. That's a Japanese martial art using swords. It's all on our website. Check it out at weekendamerica.org.
This is Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper, and we would like to end the year with you. For our final show in December, we're following up with some of the intriguing people we've met this year, and we'd like to include your story. Where did your life intersect with this year's news headlines?
Yeah, maybe it was the economy or the war, a court ruling, a medical breakthrough, something in the headlines that had a direct impact on your universe. How did the events of this year truly affect your life?
We really want to know. So talk to us when you're spending time at our website, which is weekendamerica.org. Well, rain in the West this weekend, snow and sleet in the Midwest. No help for the Southeast drought. It's mostly warm and dry there. Here is John Moe's look at weekend weather.
It's one thing to run on a warm spring day, but a triathlon in Palmer, Alaska in the winter amid snow and 32? Well, you have to be dedicated. Or bonkers. Or both. The Colony Christmas Triathlon includes a 15K bike ride, 5K run, and a 500-meter swim, which I pray is in an indoor pool. There's also a fourth event, screaming, "Get me a parka!" as loudly as possible. NASCAR is on a break, but shopping cart racing season is just heating up. Sun in 56 at Santa Monica, California's Shopping Cart Derby. Teams race through an obstacle course, loading their carts with grocery items and smashing into opponents. Winner gets a year's supply of coffee, which, if you're the type of person who gets aggressive with shopping carts, might not be the best idea. 22 degrees and snowy in Blue Mounds, Wisconsin, unless you're inside a cave, where the Caroling at the Caves event takes place. Enjoy refreshments, a visit from Santa, or Cave Santa, and traditional Christmas songs like Silent Night, We Three Kings, and Help, We Are Trapped in a Cave, Please Rescue Us. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
Hey, did you hear the one about the African Swedish Jew and the Filipino German who was raised in Japan? Coming up on Weekend America. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. Our show is about what America is doing on the weekend, like going to comedy clubs.
My father's Swedish, my mother's African-American. You know what that makes me in New York City? A Puerto Rican. That's right. That's what it makes you. That's what it makes you. But that works for me, because when that Puerto Rican Day Parade comes to New York City, I'm marching along with the rest of them J-Los. Okay, honey? I'm like, excuse me, muévete! My name is Maria Santiago de Velasquez, Barranquilla, Bogota, Puerto Rico!
That was Sunda Kronquist. She's performing at the Laugh Factory in Hollywood this weekend. Sunda is one of the voices in a new documentary that's called Crossing the Line, Multiracial Comedians. It was produced by comedian Taya Arboleda. Now, raised in Japan, Taya is Filipino-Chinese, African-American, Native American, and German-Danish. His documentary explores a world where the line between racism and humor is not black and white. Taya, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Desiree. Good to be here.
Why a documentary about multiracial comedy and comedians as opposed to multiracial education or food or cultural conflicts?
If you're too serious about some of the issues that we have in this country, race and culture issues, and I think that it's difficult for a lot of people to listen to it, to absorb it. And I think that humor certainly opens it up. I think comedians also really go the edge. They have to step over that edge. And I think that sometimes without stepping over the edge, the truth doesn't come out.
Okay, so if comedians have to go up to the edge, where exactly is the edge? Like, where is that line?
Well, I don't think there really is a particular line. I think the lines come in many, many forms and colors and shapes and sizes, and I think that part of it is the context. So if humor lies in what we say with respect to the reaction of our audience, then we have to understand who the audience is. So let's say if you are a black and white comedian and if you look black, then it's easier for you to make jokes generally about being black. But if you don't look stereotypically black, then it's more difficult to cross that line. Multiracial comedians have the advantage, however, of crossing many lines, but they have the disadvantage of having to explain who they are.
I've noticed that comedy is often, you know, at its core, there's often this little discomfort or even pain behind a lot of comedy. Where is the pain when it comes to multicultural comedy?
A lot of young people especially have to, you know, they want to belong. They want to belong to a group, whatever kind of group that is. Mm-hmm. And in order to belong to a group, race plays a large role and has played a large role. So you really kind of have to identify, for the most part, with one race generally. You know, other kids used to throw stuff at my brother and I, and they used to say things to us like, you know, are you going to play with us? Are you going to play with them? A lot of my angst growing up and a lot of the things I've had to deal with were about that.
Where was a moment for you where the pain was either so unexpected or ridiculous that it occurred to you that it was funny?
I was standing at in a supermarket once, and I was buying some pita bread and hummus, and there was these two large guys standing near me, white guys, and one guy leaned over to the other. He said, "Hey, take a look at this guy." And I looked over at one of them, and he said, "Hey, you, take your pita bread and your hummus and go back to Mexico." And so, you know, I took my pita bread, my hummus, and I moved to Mexico. And but, you know, was it funny at the time? No, actually, I was pretty scared.
Wow. Well, Taya, thank you for sharing your experiences with us, and good luck on your documentary.
Thank you, Desiree.
Taya's documentary, Crossing the Line, Multiracial Comedians, also features comedian Mark Yaffe.
I was recently accosted by a white supremacist. This guy walked up to me and goes, "Hey, you, hey, I wish your minorities would all go back to your own country." I'm like, "Dude, I'm Navajo. I'm in my own country." Last time I checked, you weren't on the guest list.
Mark was raised by his adoptive parents, Mexican Catholic mother, Irish Jewish father. And then in his 20s, he was contacted by his birth mother, who turned out to be Navajo. He often refers to himself as a Mexaho or Adoptaho. And I asked him about which comedy circuit he tends to gravitate toward.
You know, being like part Mexican, sometimes I'll be in L.A. and I'll go up and do the Refried Fridays, which is, you know, Latino night at the Improv. Or, you know, I tour also with three other Native American comics. We have what's called the Powwow Comedy Jam, and our slogan, "Taking Back the Land, One Joke at a Time."
Do the Native audiences accept you as a Native comic?
Yeah, I mean, I always explain myself straight out of the box. You know, I don't represent to be someone from the res. I grew up in, you know, an urban area. I joke about my kids, Little Big Mouth and Grounded Till Christmas. And you know, I just try to just make fun of myself and how I relate to the culture, and people are pretty supportive.
Is that tough for you to identify who you are ethnically before you can launch into your routine, or do you do that?
For some reason, it seems to work better in my act when I come right out, because people are confused. You know, like, Mexicans think I'm Indian. A lot of Indians think I'm Asian. Cops think I'm a suspect. So, you know what I'm saying? It's people look at me and they're not quite sure. There's a familiarity that an audience likes to have. I try to embrace the whole thing and my whole background. You know, it's more fun for me to bring it out.
Are you finding that audiences are growing for your kind of humor?
I think so. If you look at the demographics of the country, we're, you know, more, you know, mixed families, and I'll go to, you know, a deaf comedy type show, and then there'll be all sorts of, there'll be Latino and white folks, and we'll come to our Powwow Comedy Jam, and sometimes the audiences will be 50-60% non-native, which is great. So I think it's really a bridge. That's, I feel, is a multicultural comic. I'm a bridge, you know, between different groups to say, you know, laughter brings us together.
Well, Mark, thank you for joining us at Weekend America.
Hey, it was great being here. I hope people will see humor as a chance to grow together as a people and laugh and heal.
Indeed. Mark Yaffe will be performing tonight at Bob Zaney's Comedy Outlet in Morro Bay, California. And you can find a link to video of actually all the comics in this piece. They're performing at our website. Check it out at weekendamerica.org.
Well, that's it for this hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. We're glad you spent it with us. You know, you can take us with you. Download a free podcast of the whole show at weekendamerica.org. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper, hoping you're having a great time wherever you're headed this weekend.
Financial information brought to you by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
What do you get when you mix wine, a few hors d'oeuvres, gay marriage, and the war in Iraq? In Iowa, it's a party.
Every caucus, he would bring his platform to legalize marijuana. And so the group would respectfully listen to him read through his platform that he had very professionally written out. And then they would very respectfully vote it down.
The political house party on the next Weekend America. Join us.